All right. We have the final 2 hours together. Yeah. So I'm going to walk you through some of my favorite diagrams that I use the most. So I don't know if you're in the habit of showing anything visually, but I really do believe that, it can really help if they can see a little something. You don't have to be an artist either. Even when I didn't have an office and I didn't have a dry board, you know, when I was in my den or when I was in a restaurant, I was drawing on a napkin or drawing on the back of a paper placemat. Just when people can see it as you say it, I just think it's very helpful. And I'm talking about stick figures. I'm using stick figures and lines. But like I said to you, with the couple that I'm working with, I'm going to show it to you in this workshop. There's something I do the first night or afternoon that I meet with them, and I can just keep referring back to it. Keep referring back to it throughout the counseling. And I just find that the way God made people, there's something about hearing it and seeing it that can add some additional punch to all that is going on. So some of all that I'm going to try to get through here in these 2 hours, most all of it you'll find in the book Gospel Trees and examples of how I'm using it. And as I said to you already, all of this you can find at my website. So everything I'm referring to here you can find at the website if you're interested in more. So let me show you what I do in that first session. Doesn't matter what the problem is, I'm going to do this. Now, they told me because I'm PowerPoint and they're pro presenter, unfortunately, but we're going to make this work. Normally, I build this gradually and parts go up there, and they said we can't do that. So there it is. Boom. But here's how I do this. I'll draw two people, and I'll do these lines horizontal back and forth. And I don't have God up there yet, and I don't have those other arrows, so pretend they're not there. So I'll show how, typically when someone comes in, and this is an example of marriage, but like I said, 85% of my counseling is marriage. You can still make this work without it being marriage, but I'm going to give it in a marriage context. The focus is usually almost always on that other person, horizontal level. And that's why then I'll draw a little eye and say, you're so busy watching that other person, focusing on what they're doing wrong, telling them what they're doing wrong, and they think, as they come into counseling, the way this will work is they will simply tell you also, and you also, with them, will tell their spouse what to change. That's the mindset that they have when they come for counseling. And so then I say, you have had a list. I'll draw a little list there with some marks on it. You've had a list where you're thinking about what your spouse needs to change, what they've been doing wrong, how they've been doing wrong. And I'll say, what I want you to do in our time together, as we work together, is I would like for you to change your focus, and I would like for you to make your focus, and then I draw these arrows, and I draw a triangle, and I say, pleasing God. Not watching your spouse, not keeping tabs of what they're doing or not doing, but you're going to change your focus to pleasing God, and trust God with your spouse. This is very scary for them. You will see the look on their face like, oh my goodness, no way, that will never work. Because they're convinced, I have got to keep on them and telling them, and you need me to tell you what I need you to tell them. This is a huge paradigm shift. Would you, by God's grace, shift your focus to say, God, I want to please you. I'm going to make my focus pleasing you, whatever. Remember how I told you I'm getting them to pray? Show me what you want me to see about who? Oh, wow. Break my heart. Me. We talked about this. I thought you wanted help. Show me all you want me to see about me. And so from the very first night, I'm giving this new orientation. It is going to be about, what am I not seeing about me? What am I not seeing about me? How am I a part of the problem? How am I sinning? What am I blind to? This is different. And then, God, I want to please you. Regardless of what she does, regardless of what he does, I want to please you. And then I draw a little set of scales, and I'll say, typically everybody comes in and they think it's going to be who's most wrong. And so as a counselor, I'm going to listen, and then I'm going to blow the whistle. I'm going to say, you are the loser, and you are the winner. They come in as if it's a competition. Somebody's most wrong. And the counselor's, and I'll tell them, that is not what this is about. So what I want you to make your part, I want you to focus 100% on your part of the problem. You may say, oh, I'm only 80% of the problem. That's typically what people think. And I'm only 20% of the problem. She's 80% of the problem. The spouse has it exactly the opposite. And I'll say, I don't really care. I'm not here to prove that. Whatever your part of the problem is, whatever God reveals to you, I'm asking you, would you be willing to work 100% on your part, whatever God shows you? Because again, without being like PhDs in counseling, I hope you realize it doesn't matter what model of counseling you align yourself with, there is one person that you can change. Who's that? Self. We can start to get traction as soon as someone finally settles into, oh, what can I do about me? How am I adding to this problem? What would God show me about me? So this is in the first session, I'm going to save some time to show this. The very first session, because this is the goal. I'll say to them, after I've walked through some of the paperwork and listened well and asked questions, I'll say, now, before I send you home, I want you to know what my goal is. Because if we don't have the same goal, you're going to be frustrated with me. So I want you to know what my goal is. And then I go to the board and I draw this and I say, my goal is to help you please God in this trial. It's not to fix that other person. It's not to give you your dream come true, but to help each of you become more of God's kind of person. So that's my goal. So I don't want you to be frustrated with me as we move forward. So I say, well, we'll have to have the same goal. Then I say, you got to have some hope. Very often they've waited so long, they don't have hope. They're there, but usually they're not convinced this can get any better. And the couple that I started with now, I mean, you can see it all over their faces, their body language. We're here, but we're not here. This is just a last-ditch effort to throw some dust on this coffin and say, done. So they don't have a lot of hope. My go-to verse for giving them hope in that first night is 1 Corinthians 10:13. I said, do you have your Bible? Uh-huh. Turn to 1 Corinthians 10:13, one of them. Read that. No temptation is overtaking you. Temptation, the word in the Greek there, can be translated trial. It can be translated either way. Because often when you're in a trial, you're tempted to do something very sinful and stupid. There is no temptation or trial that's overtaking you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted or tried beyond what you're able, but will with the temptation provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear up under it. And then I'll go to the board and I'll say, I see in this one verse four promises from God that I think combat four of the most common lies. Usually when you're suffering and you're stuck, our enemy is lying to us in four significant areas. And again, I usually am able to show this to you gradually instead of all at once. And I say, number one, here's the first promise you can see. Your trial is not unique. It's common. No temptation is overtaking you except such as common. Again, I don't want to make light of it. It doesn't mean it doesn't matter. You shouldn't have come tonight. But it is within the realm of what God traffics in. Our God helps people with troubles like yours. It's common to man. The lie that often they're hearing from the enemy is no one's ever gone through anything like this before. Everybody thinks that they fit somehow in a unique category. That's not helpful. What that does is that causes them to think that God's word doesn't apply or there's not hope for them. It's common. It's not unique. Then I'll say, here's a second promise. Your God is faithful. And I'll read that second phrase, but God is faithful. Because very often by the time they come, they're Christians or they're professing Christians. What do you think they've already done? Lots. When I say to someone, what have you done about the problem so far? What do you think the number one answer is I get? Prayed about it. Prayed about it. Now, here's an interesting, let me throw this out to you. When you hear that, let me encourage you to make your next question, and what has God revealed that you should do about it in answer to your prayer? You will usually get deer in the headlight looks. Because most Christians think prayer is, I just tell God to change things and he just changes things, or he doesn't. They never think, you pray, you listen, He leads you to do something different than you've been doing about the problem. No. They've been praying and they haven't seen anything change, and therefore they think God's abandoned them. He's not faithful. He's left them. Nope. God is there for you. He's not left you on your own. Third promise, it's not more than you can handle. There's no temptations overtaking you such as is common. God is faithful and will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. But the lie that we hear in our heads is this is too much. No one can endure this. The combination of all that's going on in this right now, it's too much. It's too much. Which is often how we feel in the midst of adversity and trials and suffering. One of the most convicting things, those of you that are parents will know this, one of the most convicting things that you can hear is what comes out of the mouths of your children that you realize, I think they heard that from us. And so we were living in a mobile home when it had all hit the fan really hard. I was making $10,000 a year. I was full-time working on my MDiv, and we're in marriage counseling, and it was just hard. No excuse for my sin, but it was hard. And so one of the first things our oldest daughter said besides no, mama and daddy, she had blonde hair and she had a little grocery cart, plastic grocery cart that we still have downstairs in the den because I'm not allowed to throw it away because it's for the grandkids one day. So we still have this little grocery cart as well as all kinds of other kitchen stuff that I was ready to throw away. But she would push that around the mobile home and say, I can't handle this. I can't handle this. I can't handle this. It was so convicting. I was like, oh, do we say that a lot? I guess so. I can't handle this. So very often your counselees are thinking, my situation's unique. God has abandoned us or we wouldn't have gotten to this point, and I can't handle this. So we've already got three promises that combat three of the most common lies that are rumbling around in their head. And then finally, there's a fourth promise. There is a way out of this. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but will with the temptation make or provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear up under it. So even in that opening night, often I myself really don't have all the answers. So by faith, and this is not all bad, I have to look at them and say, I'm excited to walk with you all together. And I'm confident that God has a way through this. God has a way through this. And I want to walk with you through this. And I myself often think, and God, I look forward to seeing what that is as you reveal. Because tonight, I don't know. This is the biggest mess. It is so complicated. I'm not sure where we would start. But I'm trusting in Him. I'm trusting in Him. This is His promise to me too. So there's times as a counselor, woo, what you're hearing, you're like, oh my goodness. And you got to say, wait a minute. God traffics and stuff like this. God's with me as a counselor. This is not more than I can bear as a counselor. And it's certainly more than I can in my own strength and wisdom, but He's with me. And He's going to show us. He's going to show us a way through this. So I want them to have the right goal. It's pleasing God and seeing how I'm sinning. I want them to have hope. There's a way out. Then thirdly, before I send them home, I want them to know what I need from them. So I'll say, our counseling's free. So I'll say, hey, the counseling's free. But here's what I need from you. If you're going to work with me, here's what I need from you. Number one, I need you to bring a learner spirit. I'll say, I need you to give me permission to speak into your life, to poke, to prod. Because I don't know. I can't see the heart. I have to ask questions. I have to come at this. And then I have to come at it this way. And I might come back and ask questions again. Now, who do you think it is? Well, maybe you don't know. But through counseling, it is the men sometimes that do not like to be questioned and to be poked and to be prodded. So I'll look at both of them and say, Bob, will you bring a learner spirit? And are you willing to have me ask questions? I'm going to have to ask questions and kind of poke and get in there because I don't know. Okay? And Sally, are you willing? Will you bring a learner spirit? See, very often they're coming having already been judge and jury, and they think they know exactly what is wrong. That won't work. Learner spirit. Number two, I need you to do some homework. This is not the magic hour. So I already had an hour with you about homework. But I'll tell them, here's what homework does. I'm not just looking to keep you busy and to waste your time this week. Like I said to you in that previous hour, I am giving you something that is a part of where I want to lead you, and it will actually be our discussion in our next session. So you will not be wasting your time. But I need you to do some homework. And then I'll go to the board and I'll just draw dots like this. And I'll say, here's the difference. Without homework, then we meet on Tuesday night at 6 o'clock. And when I meet with Brad and we talk about it, there seems to be clarity. And I start to get hope and I feel a little better. And then we drive off and we don't do anything about it or think about it or continue. And so it just sinks and then we meet. And it sinks and then we meet. And then it sinks and then we meet. And if you're doing this for $200 an hour for a living, you might love that and say, let's do this for 10 years. But I'm a pastor and we're doing it for free, so I'm not trying to see how long this can take. Homework keeps the process going. And I'll just draw, the dip doesn't go as low. But I've got them thinking about this, reading something related to what we talked about, reading something preparing their heart to where we're headed next, or listening to a message that helps. Every week, I know I keep referring to this couple, but it's been so encouraging. Every week when they come in, I can see a difference in them from before, from the effect the homework had on them. In a sense, counseling continues outside of that moment by homework. But give good homework and don't give too much. So I'll say, I need you to be willing to do some homework. Again, who is it that you think will struggle the most with this? Men. You know? It's just hilarious. I'll get hers back. And I mean, it is crammed with words. And it's got post-it notes dangling off the edges where she's added things. And his, it'll be the same question. His is like, yeah. You've overwhelmed me with details, Bill. Like, could we tease that out a little more? You know? But from both, I'm like, I need you to do some homework. I need some time. I'll say, we didn't get into this mess overnight. You're not going to get out of it overnight. It's going to take some time. But I like to frame it up for them like with seasons. You know, instead of saying how many sessions, because again, I give hope. So like with this couple, I started meeting with them late July, early August. They're living in separate, you know, dwellings. Their chairs are turned sideways. Very cold, opposite sides of the conference room when I go out to get them. So in that first session, I said these very things. I said, now I'm going to need some time. And I looked at both of them and said, now I know you just separated, Bill. You left. Is it your intent to divorce her? Like, are you just on your way out, or will you give me some time? He said, no, I'll give you some time. I'm not about to. I said, thank you. So then I said this. I said, imagine, this is July. Imagine come Easter, late March, early April. We've been through our Cincinnati winter. Crocuses are starting to pop up through the ground. Early spring and colors are arriving. Imagine relating to each other very differently than you are tonight and having a very different marriage than you do now. Would you be willing to give me that kind of time? Because again, people are busy, they've got sports, they've got jobs, they've got businesses, so we're not going to fix this in two sessions, but when you put it in terms like that with the calendar, wow, this is July, is our marriage worth, can we go to the spring and see what God might do? So that's how I try to talk to them and give me some time. Then I added this fourth one, and I'll tell them, I didn't used to have this one, I only had three till like 6 or 7 years ago. But I kept running into this problem, so I've added this fourth. I need you to be broken and desperate enough to actually be willing to change instead of just going through the motions and talking about how hard it is. Believe it or not, there are a lot of people in a lot of really hard places that still don't want to change. And it doesn't matter what model of counseling you give them. Straight up Freud, integration, biblical counseling, It doesn't matter what you call it or how you approach it. When someone doesn't want to change, the counseling process is done. And I've run into it quite a bit, sadly. And here's how I'll correct them. I'll say to my counselees, we're like at session 6, session 7 maybe. And I started out this way, framed it up this way for them. But they keep doing the homework except anything that's related to changing how they relate to each other. They'll memorize the verse, answer some questions, listen to the CD, but change nothing about how they're relating to each other. And I'll say to them, you guys, this is not a Bible study. This is counseling. It's all about change. I'm not seeing either one of you willing. Did you do three loving deeds? No. Did you forget? No. What's going on? Not going to do that. Oh, you're not. What? And it's that. You see, anything that was related to directly how they relate to each other, it's a stalemate. And so you're wasting your time. You can do a Bible study on Ephesians 5. You can read all kinds of wonderful booklets. You can listen to sermons. But you're going nowhere if people don't want to change. If they won't humble themselves and say, all right. So then I send them on their way. It's like, here's the goal. Here's hope. Here's the commitment I need from you. And I send them on. Usually my first assignment is to memorize that verse about the goal. Therefore, we make it our goal or aim to be well-pleasing to Him. So here's something else then that I use all the time. That is how I begin a first session, always framing it up. But here's something, again, oh, I'm so sorry, I can't build these things and they all just show up. But anyway, so people talk about the feelings all the time. And God is not against feelings. Please know, as biblical counselors, we're not against feelings. We're not saying, let's pretend we don't have feelings. God created us as creatures in His image with emotions. You see emotions in the Psalms. You see emotions throughout the Scriptures. We're not against feelings. That's not what we're saying in the biblical counseling camp. But what the Bible does teach is that we're not to be ruled by our feelings. And so I'll jump to the board at some point in the counseling. This is not one of those things like, oh, I just showed you some things I always do in the first session. This is like, I don't know when I'll do it, but I'm going to do it. So when people observe me, they'll often say, ooh, Pastor Brad, do you always do that in the sixth session? No. But I have certain things that I am going to show them at some point, and this is one of them. So I go to the board, and I'll just draw the word stimuli. And I'll say, here's what the Bible teaches about how we're wired and how we function. Stuff happens. Stimuli. You lost your job. You found out you've got prostate cancer. You found out your daughter is pregnant. We can't control what happens. Stuff happens. And then I draw an arrow this way, and it does not have a heart around it yet. And I draw the word thinking. The Bible teaches us that we think something about it. We're saying something to ourselves. Because we're created in the image of God, we are the creatures in all of the universe that want things to make sense. We're interpreters. We want to connect the dots. But why? How does this make sense? You think about it. There's no other creature in the universe that has a philosophy department, right? We do. Because we're created in the image of God, we want it to make sense. It's not enough to just breed and work and die. You know, golden retrievers don't get together and discuss. Dogs don't lay around together and say, why do we chase cars? You know, we lost Freddie last week and yet we still do it. What drives this? Why do I? No. We do, right? I mean, we have philosophy departments where it's not enough. It's not enough. I was thrilled on Sunday. My new son-in-law is a new Christian, just 2 years into the faith. And so he's still in that sweet season where everybody he knows is not a Christian. All of his friends. And so he's just bringing everybody, or trying to bring everybody. And so there's this guy he's been trying to get to come for months and months and months. They call him Bill. And he's 6'10". He played basketball with him. So I've met him at the wedding. So I knew I'm preaching in the third service. And I'm like, oh my goodness, that is so. Because he's like, yeah, there's people and then there's this man. And so as soon as I finished, I ran down the aisle. to call his name and said, "Oh man, I'm so glad you came." And but here's what I love about my son-in-law Ryan. He doesn't just bring people. He's very intentional. Then he'll take them out to lunch, and he doesn't just hope they'll talk about it. He'll say, "So, what did you think? What did you think?" So, you know, this was a sermon where I was talking about sexual sin. I mean, it was very direct. Pornography, self-pleasure, masturbation, fornication, adultery, homosexuality. This was like very biblical and very loving, but very direct. You know, some people were like, "I have never heard anybody say that in church." So it was that kind of Sunday. So he says to Bill, "So, what did you think?" And he had gone out drinking with some people the night before till the wee hours of the morning. But Ryan was actually thrilled that he still came. So Ryan knew he went out, and he called him at 10:15 and said, "Hey, you still coming to church?" He said, "Yeah." And the AC broke on Sunday. And so it was, I kid you not, it was so hot that my two wet pits had met in the middle. And my whole shirt, by the third service, these two wet spots had just merged into one. It was so hot in that room. Oh, and so he says to Ryan, "I'm a big man. I'm stuffed down into this little chair. It is so hot. I've had a cup of coffee. I'm slightly hungover, and he's talking to me about my sin." But he liked it. And I'll tell you why he liked it. Because he's almost done with his PhD. His grandfather just died and left him a ton of money, and his father is dying of cancer. And so his whole life he said there is no God, and he's at this point where he said to Ryan, "You know, there must be a God." So human beings are the one. I need something to frame this up. I need this to make sense. That's us. We think something about everything that is happening. We talk to ourselves. We rehearse things to ourselves. And what the Bible teaches that as you think enough in a certain direction, you begin to feel. You begin to have emotions. You feel a certain way. But those feelings are fed by thoughts. And if you feel a certain way long enough, then usually we begin to take action. And we begin to make decisions to either do or not do things based on what we're feeling. And if you do it enough, then I'll draw TEA, enough of the same thinking, emoting, and acting in the same direction, it can produce a character. It's kind of like, it's just kind of who I am. You'll hear people say, "Well, that's just who I am." And you'll think about someone who, all of us at one point or another have gotten angry. But can you not think of someone when you just say, "That's an angry man. He's just settled in there. It characterizes him." It would be true about any other issue. So you've gone so long down this path. And so I'll show them this and say, look, you could have gone to some counseling. You could have gone and gotten some counseling that just tries to help you change your behavior. And the first time I tried to get help on our marriage, that's kind of what it was like. It's like, "Well, you got to date your wife, Pastor Brad. Just date her again like you used to." They're going right here after behavior. And it's true. But guess what happened? When I would try to do that, it didn't last very long. Why? Because they had not gotten at what I was thinking. And here's where I'll say, we're most conscious of our emotions, what we're feeling. But the Bible teaches that emotions are fed by thinking. And then I'll draw a heart around thinking. And I'll say, when the Bible talks about the heart, it's not talking about just emotions. There's some emotion there. There's some affection. But the Bible, when it talks about heart, is talking about your thinking, your affections, your motives, what you really believe and want and why. That is all called the heart in the Bible. That's why Proverbs 4:23 says, guard your heart. And so I'm laying out for them, we've got to start to get a hold of, what have you been saying to yourself? What have you been believing? What have you been prizing and wanting and protecting or promoting most or worshiping? That if we don't get a hold of this, and often I don't think they're lying. They'll say, "I don't know what I'm thinking. I just feel." Okay, I get it. But it's almost like it's a new muscle that has to be exercised. My favorite illustration that I'll give, because I played tennis in high school, I'll say, most people who've tried to play tennis would have experienced this. A backhand, unless you were just some amazing natural athlete, is one of the most awkward things I've ever tried to do. You just think, I am never going to be able to do this. Forehand, I can get. And my dear father, I started playing when we lived in Spain, he would just switch hands. So he never learned a backhand. And you can do that when you're playing people that aren't good and the ball is going, dink. And you've got like 10 whole seconds to change hands. But if you want to be good, that isn't going to work. It needs to stay in the same hand. And you've got to be able to turn. And that is a very awkward angle. And you're going like this now. But guess what? If you do it long enough, and I stood hitting against the wall over and over and over, all of a sudden, you can. And so I'll tell them, this might feel like so awkward. They're like, it's just so awkward. This can't be right. I know. I'll say, this is going to be like a new muscle you've got to train, but I need you to start to become aware of, what are you thinking? What are you saying to yourself? You are thinking something. Think about all the verses that tell us so. Proverbs 23:7, as a man or woman, what? Feels? Thinks in her heart, so is she. Guard your heart. 2 Corinthians 10:5, casting down arguments and taking every thought captive. Romans 12:2, be transformed in the renewing of your mind. Ephesians 4:22, be renewed in the spirit of your mind. Philippians 4:8, whatever things are true and lovely and honest and good, think on these things. The Bible goes after our heart or thinking. Our affections, what do we want? What do we believe? What are we saying? What are we rehearsing? How are we connecting the dots? So when you're trying to counsel people, they may not be aware of it, but you've never tried to counsel someone who has not in some way connected the dots of life. They may have connected them poorly, but they're believing something. They've settled into something. They have an interpretation in some way of life. Because no human being has the capacity to just go, blank screen, I don't care, I just live life. No, you just can't do it. By nature, we're created in the image of God to want this to make sense. And so notice, the scripture does not say, we live in a culture that thinks, if you want to be authentic, if you really want to know right or wrong, right, what should you do? Follow your heart. Go with your heart. I mean, every Hallmark made-for-television movie has this moment. That's supposed to be just so sweet, you know? But it's so foolish. Where the mother is sitting on the edge of the daughter's bed and she's trying to make a decision between this guy or that guy or moving to New York City or staying in Boston. And then there's this moment where the writers just think, oh, this is so profound. And she says, well, I can't really tell you one way or another, honey, but one thing I do know, follow your heart. And I just want to go, do not follow your heart. Please don't follow your heart. The Bible does not teach that. Look at this. And guide your heart in the way. Do you realize the Bible actually tells you to tell your heart where to go? Yeah. Tell it where to go. Guide it. Push it. Shape it. Lead it. It does not say follow it. It does not say follow your heart. Psalm 119:12, I have inclined my heart to perform your statutes. The Bible says the heart matters. Oh, it does, because out of the heart flows the issues of life. But it doesn't say just follow it. I've got to inform my heart according to God's word. I've got to renew my heart and mind and then direct it. In fact, there are times to obey God and to please God and to be wise, I have to literally trample across my feelings. We live in a day that everybody wants their feelings to be exactly in line with what they're doing. They think they have to feel it or they're not being real and authentic. No, here's what it means when you do contrary to what you feel. That's called maturity. Because here's what the pushback I get. Well, I don't want to be a hypocrite, Pastor Brad. Now, here's my answer every time. Because usually I'm asking them to do something in their marriage they don't feel yet. So like that couple, I was wanting them to get together, and things are not all hunky-dory or great. But I'm going to move you in the direction of what is right, and I am convinced that feelings can follow right behavior. When you wait around for feelings to show up, often you just wait around a long time. And so it's not wrong to make a choice that pleases God, but I don't feel it yet. And so I'll say to them, oh, okay, you don't want to be a hypocrite? What about when the alarm goes off Monday morning and you work a job? Do you just launch out of bed and say, oh my goodness, I get to work for XYZ company today. We're going to do it again. I'm going to work the phones again. Oh, I love it. Let me put on my shirt, my logo. Here I go. And I don't know if any bosses or supervisors are out there in the edge of the parking lot as everyone's whirling in at 5 till 8 saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Don't want any hypocrites here today. If you're not feeling it, just get back in your car. No, they'll take you. Get on in there. Get to your desk. Boot the laptop up. Get on the phones. Start doing your daggone job, whether you feel it or not. And we do it in every other area of life. But all of a sudden, people want to act super spiritual in relationship. Well, I don't want to be a hypocrite. Please, be a hypocrite. Because that's not being a hypocrite. Obeying God despite your feelings is the difference between maturity and immaturity. It's the difference between moving forward in life and not. So you're going to have to help people, because what they're hearing from the world is they think it's most authentic if they only do what they feel. And that's how people got where they are. Oh, this is most unfortunate that all that is there. Pretend there's one little circle in the middle. Pretend with me that this is all you see right now, this one little circle. So I'm going to walk through this one and then we'll take a break. Here's something else that I often end up showing someone, whether it's worry, whether it's fear, whether it's responsibility and feeling overwhelmed with all that is going on. I have found this so helpful, and I think I got this from Paul Tripp. So I'll draw one circle on the board and I'll say, God calls us to responsibility in areas of our life to know he's called me to do this and I can't pass this off to anyone else. Because often when someone's overwhelmed, they're anxious, they're fearful, they have taken on more than God has called them to do. We all have another circle of concern. There's things that we're concerned about, but guess what? It's not our responsibility. He hasn't called us to solve it or take care of that. So I start just trying to help them draw out, what is it that you're lying away thinking? What is it that overwhelms you in the shower or in the car? What are all these things? And we just start listing them. Every time I've ever tried to help someone, including myself, I've found you can make some distinctions. There are some things that I'm concerned about that are weighing on me, and they fit in the circle of my responsibility. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. My 15-year-old, and I don't have a 15-year-old son, but if I did, my 15-year-old son, who's in my home, and I'm concerned that I found out he's looking at porn. Is that my responsibility to do something about that and to address that, or is that just a concern? Responsibility. My 27-year-old son that is not good with his money and is about to buy a red sports car and cannot afford the insurance, is that my concern or my responsibility? Concern. You see where we're headed? It's amazing. If you just start, you'll have a smaller list, because now I'm just focused on my responsibilities. And then the hymn writer got it right. Trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus. With the things that God has called me to that are my responsibility, I must obey. And so then I helped my counselee to begin to write a plan. What could we do about those areas? Now we got a shorter list. The other list, what do? You trust God. You pray. I mean, the truth of it is, if we wrote that hymn the way we'd really like, it's like, obey and obey, for there's no other way, for we truly don't like to trust God. Christians don't. I mean, even listen to the voice inflection when we go there. Well, I guess we're just going to have to trust God with that. Like, oh, wow, has it come to that? We'd never want to do that. Trust God. Isn't there something we can do? Let's think real hard. There's got to be something else we can do before we trust God with that. Right? It's just like we are control freaks. Not one particular gender, not one particular age. Human beings. We actually don't like trusting God. And so therefore we take on more than he's called us to do. So often, like if you're counseling, make sure you ask good questions. But even in a small group setting or Sunday school or whatever, there'll be someone who just keeps asking for prayer. Oh, pray for me. Pray that God give me grace. Oh, I just need grace. There's so much going on right now. It's so hard. I'm feeling overwhelmed. And don't hear me saying you shouldn't be compassionate. Don't hear me saying to embarrass them. But somebody lovingly should pull them aside and say, hey, could I want to help you some more. What is all that's going on? And if you listen, you'll hear things that are not their responsibility. And as you try to help them lay it down, you often will find they don't want to lay it down. I'll say to some people, look over your shoulder. If you see a cape blowing in the wind, you're probably in trouble. God hasn't called us to swoop in. And there are swoopers, you know that? That just think, I've got to do it. I've got to do it. I've got to do it. And some of it really boils down to, if I trust God with it, it might not happen the way I think it should happen. Trust. So when someone is anxious, fearful, overwhelmed, oh, it can be so helpful to just help them walk through. What are areas that right now it is my responsibility? What are areas that it needs to be put in the circle of concern? And I pray about those things, and I pray about these things and take action. See, because a lot of Christians, I don't think, understand, God did not promise to give you grace to do what he's not asked you to do. We've got Christians holding on to stuff, crying out for grace, and wondering what's wrong with God. He didn't call you to do that, and he will not grace you to do it. If you want to hold on to all that, you will implode, and you will feel overwhelmed. There was a lady that was new to our church, and they had moved, if you can imagine, to Northern Kentucky from New York. And they were, you know, just like you all think what you think about us, you know, no shoes, no teeth, and everything we thought about New York City, you know, the how they talk and what they look like, to a T. He had black hair swept back. His name was Vinny. And just so funny to be around and hear them talk. But she came, and she's a brand new Christian. So it's just like, you know, brand new Christians can be very exciting. It's kind of raw. When you add the whole New York element, really raw. And there she is. And she's overwhelmed. She's a research nurse in Cincinnati at this big-time, high-pressure company. And she's got two teenage boys and some rough stuff going on. So I meet with her, with Vicky, in the den. And I use this very diagram right here. I just started sorting some of it out. And everybody that comes to you for help, you don't have to necessarily take from now till spring when the crocuses come up. Sometimes, in one or two sessions, people just get it. She was one of those. She just got this. And you could visibly see her, like, blossom. And we sent her on her merry way. And we just hadn't run into each other for a little while. We were meeting at Dixie High School at the time. And Vicky ran into her, like, 3-4 weeks later in the bathroom on Sunday morning. And she's like, let's call her Sally. Oh, Sally, how are you doing since we met? I remember, new Christian. And she's like, oh, Vicky, honey, I'm doing so good. I'm just staying right there in my damn little circle. Just right there, staying in my damn little circle. Mm. And she's the same one that would grab my hand at the front door and just pump it and say, hell of a sermon. Hell of a sermon. Like, oh, thank you. And she's grown some more. And, but I mean, she was just, even with unbelievers, I am so encouraged. God's word is true, right? And he knows how he made us. It's so exciting when you see people put it into practice. I remember way back when I first moved there, there was there was a house with multiple families living there. I don't exaggerate, like four families and all these people. And one of the guys I had befriended, who had been in the Iron Maiden motorcycle gang, rough, lots of tattoos, long hair, looks like he's had a hard life. But he'd give you the shirt off his back, and he helped me put a mailbox up and helped me do other stuff, and I befriended him. But one day I said to him, I said, how does that work in there? You know, we got seven people, five kids, husband and wife. I said, man, that must be rough. And he's like, oh, yeah, like about once a month, we all just stand in the living room and say everything we wanted to say to each other. Just all, you know what, breaks out. I was like, oh, I don't think that's good. And so I just shared with him some biblical principles about communication, be honest, stay current, attack the problem, not the person, act, don't react. And I kid you not, I mean, he comes across like a week later, and he's like, man, dude, that shit really works. He's like, did that at the next meeting. He's like, dude, that Bible stuff really. It does, because God is our creator.